Blog Talk Radio.
And now, broadcasting from the banks of the historic Vermilion River, amidst the rolling prairie, cornfields, and unsightly wind farms of central Illinois, it's the Rhino Hour of Power, with your host, Rick Moran, like Diogenes without a lantern. And welcome everybody to the Rhino Hour of Power. I'm your host, Rick Moran, and joining me tonight in the second chair, the wild, the wonderful, the wacky, Fausta Wirtz. Fausta, may I have this dance? Welcome, Fausta, welcome.
Thank you, Rick. How's it going?
I don't know. I'm exhausted after that tango. No, I'm just kidding. Okay. As we usually do when I have you on the show, I look forward to it because it gives us a chance to talk about a subject nobody ever in America ever talks about, and that is Latin America.
Yeah.
There's always stuff, interesting stuff going on in Latin America. And, of course, the continuing saga in Argentina surrounding the death of the prosecutor who was just about ready to indict the president, Mrs. Kirchner, when somebody killed him, or maybe he killed himself, I guess, or something. Anyway, that's still trying to be, somebody's still trying to figure out what happened there. In the meantime, another prosecutor has stepped forward and is making plans. Is he not, Faustin?
Yes, indeed. And you and I had a discussion on this a couple of weeks ago when the first news came out. My theory all along is that this guy didn't kill himself. It's more that he was suicided because Argentina, for one, has a very long history of political suicides that just happened to be conveniently timed. So, and there is a number of conflicting points about how and what happened at the time of death and a lot of other circumstances, but the real issue, aside from the death of this young man, I mean, he was in his early 50s, he wasn't all that old, who was a person of great integrity, is Iran's role in Latin America. The reason he filed a lawsuit against the president of the country is because in the course of his investigation of the largest terrorist attack in our hemisphere prior to September 11, he uncovered evidence that Cristina Fernandez was in collusion with the government of Iran in hiding the role that Iran had played in that attack, including the current president of Iran, Rouhani, I'm not sure how to pronounce it.
Yeah,
so, exactly. So that is the main issue. So the investigation of the 1994 attack at the Amia Center, the Jewish center, the largest Jewish center in Argentina, basically led nowhere. The investigation that Nisman was called to help with had been fraught with a lot of irregularities. That's what Nisman was brought in by Nestor Kirchner, Cristina's late husband. After a while, the Kirchners were not happy with his findings. And by the time that Kirchner died and Cristina became president, it was almost a hostile relationship, to the point that Nisman supposedly had 10 bodyguards who, by the way, the weekend of his death, were none of them were on duty in the building where he lived. So,
oh boy.
Where is this going to lead? I don't know. The latest is that the Argentinian government is asking, and this is almost, I mean, this baffles me. They want the United States to help, quote, get to the bottom, help it get to the bottom of the 1994 bombing.
By asking Iran in their nuclear negotiations, they want as a side issue to ask Iran whether they did it or not, I guess, or something, or you know, whether they could help in the investigation. Well, Iran's not going to help, and they're not even going to talk about it. This is it's grandstanding by Kirchner, don't you think?
Exactly. I mean, the thing is, Cristina Fernandez is in a heap of trouble because now there is another prosecutor who is following up on the case, and there is pressure on the judges in the country for one of them to take the case. So far, two judges have turned down taking up the case. So Cristina,
can you blame them?
Yeah, well, you know, with a history of suicide.
They don't want to have a sudden case of depression and kill themselves. That makes sense. Oh, well, go ahead.
With a moving bullet hole, by the way, because first they said the bullet hole was in one place of Niesman's head, and then it was on another side, then it was on the temple, so who knows? I mean.
Yeah. Well, we'll never know. That's probably I think you mentioned that the very first day. We'll never know what happened. Well, that's proving to be true. Elsewhere in South America, Venezuela continues to amaze. The kinds of shortages they have there probably hadn't been seen since the Second World War. I mean, you know, they're out of toilet paper. Nobody can get toilet paper, which must make that a pretty smelly country. They can't get basic foodstuffs. They can't get anything. Their currency won't buy imports, so they can't get a lot of food that they usually get. And the stores are empty. What is President Maduro up to these days? Is he? I know there's been rioting in a few places, but what's his excuse now? Is it still the U.S.'s fault?
Of course, and now Maduro is saying that there was an attempted coup, and he arrested a former general of the Air Force and 10 other former military because they say that they were trying to overthrow him. Now, the thing is, the shortages are chronic, and he's also arresting the owners of supermarkets because he's saying that the supermarket owners are hoarding foodstuffs and, you know, staples and supplies to sell on the black market when, in fact, the owners of the supermarkets don't have anything to put on the shelves. The worst case was recently a small supermarket chain that normally sells in poor areas of the city called Dia Dia, and the manager and the owner were in the clink. I believe they're still in the clink. So, I mean, the World Misery Index, by the way, has Venezuela at the number one spot by a very long shot. And Professor Steve Hanke of Johns Hopkins University is rating this on inflation and unemployment and GDP. And Venezuela took the first prize by a long, long shot over the second place, which, by the way, is Argentina.
Two countries we love to hate the most. Venezuela is still in trouble.
Actually, I love Argentina. It's a very nice place. It's beautiful. I just don't want to live there.
Yeah. Ecuador, also some news out of Ecuador. Evidently, they're threatening to blow up the world or something. Wait, what's Ecuador's problem?
The problem Ecuador has right now is that the government is trying to control all the media and is trying to control all the information particularly when it pertains to the economy. Ecuador has been trying to put a happy face, saying that it's a great place for Americans to retire, that there's dollarization, and that everything is just hunky-dory. At the same time, it's running huge amounts of debt to the point that it tries. I don't know that it's going to be any successful at this. It's trying to have its own internet currency, sort of like a Bitcoin, only without the bit. And it's becoming an elected dictatorship, like what Ian Brenner refers to them. And the latest thing is that they're jailing newspapermen, and they're also fining the newspaper. Last year, there was a cartoonist who had a cartoon at a newspaper called El Universo, the Universe, and the newspaper was fined $90,000, and he was forced to redo the cartoon, and the newspaper was forced to republish it. This week, the newspaper is being forced by the government to post a public apology, which I posted on my blog. I translated it also, saying that, you know, we apologize for this cartoon, which referred to an assemblyman who was stuttering, trying to read his speech at the National Assembly, and the Correa government took offense at that, and now they force this newspaper to do this. So Ecuador is not a happy place right now, and it's a pity because it otherwise could be a very good country to live in. I mean, yeah. I know people who have lived in Ecuador and loved it.
Yeah. Finally, a story out of America having to do with Cuba, and that is Conan O'Brien is going to take his show and broadcast from Cuba. Why is a comedian wanting to go to Cuba? What's funny about Cuba? Anything?
Well, why is he going to Cuba? Because he's a fool. I mean, there are beatings every day, public beatings of the damas en de blanco, the ladies in white, who are the wives and the sisters of men who were thrown in jail several years ago, and they got beat up. There was a guy who got a dissident who got beat up to an inch of his life just last week. They are arresting people in record numbers, and the worst thing about it is this is going on while Conan is in there, and Conan has the nerve to say that he's going to give the audience a rare glimpse into Cuban daily life. He should start with that.
Well, what kind of glimpse are we going to get when he's going to have handlers galore steering him to all the socialist miracles that are happening in Cuba, and not taking him to places with rats in the hospitals and mud hut housing and nothing on the shelves for ordinary people? And, you know, you're not going to see any of that. Is he really so stupid as to believe he can actually circumvent the handlers who will be handling him?
I don't think I mean, quite frankly, I haven't watched Conan for a very long time, but I doubt that it has even crossed his mind to do anything that might get him kicked out of the country on his butt, because I would be extremely impressed if Conan got his cameraman and got himself on a good car that is actually able to run and drive through the areas of Havana that are crumbling. And the crumbling of the buildings in Cuba is horrendous. I mean, I believe I forget which association of historic sites did a count, and something like 300 historic buildings in Cuba had totally disintegrated and crumbled to the ground. So he should drive through those areas and tell people, you know, this is Cuban daily life. But I doubt that Conan has the intestinal fortitude to do something like that.
Oh yeah. That I've never watched Conan. I might have watched him when he was a replacement for the Tonight Show, but I never watched him when he had his own show. I just think it's, I think it's incredible that anybody would go to Cuba and then think that they were seeing the country as it is in a real sense, and not as the Cuban government wants you to see it. It's just, it boggles the imagination. He's just that way. Fausto, we have our guest on the line now. Our guest is Noah Rothman. He's an editor at Hot Air. Been on the show several times. Always enjoy talking to you, Noah. How you doing?
I'm doing great. Thank you very much for having me. Appreciate it.
As always, a pleasure. You're on with Fausto Wirtz of Fausto's Blog.
Hello, Noah.
What's going on? Good to talk to you.
I'm enjoying the Florida winter.
Where are you at?
Miami.
Oh, okay. Never mind.
Yeah.
I was going to commiserate, and you just ruined it.
I'm sorry.
She's going to lord it over us, that's for sure. Let's get started because this is, for once I'm not terribly angry at the Republican Party, although they're blowing it because they have no idea about messaging. They could have won this issue of Department of Homeland Security funding if they had tried to tie it directly to Obama's executive actions. But, you know, I haven't seen much of anything except on the Sunday shows, and as far as that's concerned. And the Democrats have been out there 24/7 bashing them. So, of course, the latest poll shows that the public is going to blame the Republicans if DHS runs out of funding. What do you think, Noah? First of all, do you think there is going to be a cutting of funds to DHS at the end of the month? Do you think that's going to happen?
Well, I mean, first of all, the whole ball game changed today with a court injunction on the implementation of these rulings. The Department of Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson said today that they're not going to be implementing DAPA, which is the latest round of executive actions on immigration, anytime soon. And there's going to be an appeal process, and we don't know how long that appeal process is going to last or even if this is going to be overturned tomorrow, so who knows. But it might provide Republicans with an off-ramp, at which point they could maybe at least satisfy the most satiable elements of the conservative right, who will be satisfied with the fact that these executive orders aren't going through and they can pass a clean DHS funding bill. That might happen. That was off the table before this morning. Now that's an option. But if that doesn't occur, then we're going to go forward with this action. And the best case scenario for Republicans would have been to pass something through the Senate that was maybe a little more circumspect than what was passed in the House, which forestalled or prevented the retracted the implementation of DACA and the Morton memos, immigration executive actions going back to 2011. That was never going to happen. They were going to get thrown out. So the Senate would pass something that was a little more circumspect, purely addressing this. It would go to the president's desk. He would veto it. That would be the end of the story. They could claim that there's not enough votes to override a veto, so they could claim some moral authority in trying to prevent that from going forward. I don't know what else they think could be accomplished with this strategy, although I do think it's necessary to pursue it at this stage. And it was probably necessary earlier because they have a real problem with the conservative right thinking that there's just no hill that they're willing to die on. But beyond that, I don't understand what else they could accomplish beyond securing a presidential veto and winning some sort of moral victory. So maybe they still pursue that strategy, but they do have an off-ramp now, and they might just take it.
Yeah, I read that Wall Street Journal article, too. That was that's an interesting scenario, but, you know, does McConnell have the cojones to play chicken with Harry Reid and the Democrats? That's the question. And I don't think he does. I think that if he can find a way to cut the legs from underneath the House Republicans, he's going to do it. Reid, if he's smart, will work it with McConnell on some language that they can both agree on, get the bill passed, and something even that the president would probably sign. Of course, this will enrage conservatives in the House who didn't get everything they wanted. Unless they get 100%, they're going to be mad. So, you know, that's just the way they are. I don't know. Fausta, do you have a question?
Well, if I could interject real quick, but I don't want to monopolize the conversation too much, but I do want to note that you made a good point, is that the Republicans should have known that they always had their backs up against the wall here, just by the fact that they were playing with fire in the sense that they were dealing with a shutdown. And they should have known that the messaging against that is really quite difficult. It favors Democrats because they really want everything. They hope against hope to resurrect what happened in 2013. So the GOP should have known that they would have had to speak over the heads of the press early and often to make sure that everybody knew that a DHS shutdown is not a government shutdown. The Department of Homeland Security does not shut down. They would have had to make that case early and often, and they did not. As a result, they are in a suboptimal position.
Yeah. About 80% of employees at DHS will still be working, albeit without pay. It's not going to affect the port security.
Those 80%, they'll get paid. A lot of them will get deferred checks, but not all of them are going to lose their payment. At least that's not what happened in 2013.
Yeah, okay. But they have failed to make that clear, that Homeland Security is not going to be affected by a DHS funding drought, so to speak. Go ahead, Fausta, if you have a question.
The Republicans are terrible at selling themselves and their points of view, but William Jacobson of Legal Insurrection was saying that what the Republicans should be doing is pass a 30-day spending bill and then say, you know, it cannot be acted on anyway because of the injunction, and see how the courts rule. So if the courts don't put the injunction on hold or they uphold the injunction, then they don't need to be worrying about defunding it. So how about this other time when Homeland Security basically declared all of their employees as, I forget what the term was, essential, and everybody got paid? Wouldn't that be the case anyway?
Yeah, mostly that would be the case. There are some functions that would be curtailed or shut down entirely. About 30,000 employees would get furloughed, and then there's some training programs and other sundry stuff that has little to do with the defense of the homeland. The real, you know, the work of national security doesn't just stop. And a lot of those people can be recalled, actually, in the event of an emergency. So, yeah, essentially, if you did go forward with a shutdown, that's what would happen. And it's kind of incumbent on the press to counter that message, because Democrats have a perfectly contradictory message. These immigration orders can't be stopped. They are funded through multi-year appropriations and fees. There's nothing that the Republicans can do to stop the implementation of these orders, of these executive actions, short of a court order, which happened. But also, national security will cease to function and the world will be defenseless. Those are entirely contradictory messages, and it's incumbent on the press to litigate that. But the press, you can't expect the press to litigate the Democratic messaging on this, especially since it's so attractive. The word shutdown is perfectly attractive because it just speaks to this mythological moment in Democratic history when they believed that they would finally bury Republicans, but for the intervention of the failed healthcare website. There lives this myth on the left that if were it not for the implosion of healthcare.gov, the Democrats would have retaken the House in 2014. They really believe that. A lot of people do. So to resurrect the opportunity to relive the shutdown in the absence of the failing healthcare website, they really believe that they can secure for themselves a beneficial political position. And they may not be entirely wrong. I don't know if they're right about that, but it would certainly be advantageous.
Yeah. This interesting poll from CNN today, it was kind of an eye-opener to me, because I don't know how they asked the question. But I can't believe 53% of Americans would blame Republicans if the department must shut down. Like, well, 30% would blame President Obama. 13% say both deserve the blame. I mean, especially if Obama veto, if they do get something through and Obama vetoes it, you know, how can he avoid responsibility? I don't get it. I think it's the way they ask the question, and I think it's partly also who they ask. Republicans are constantly underrepresented. Of course, pollsters have ways to weight answers so that it all comes out equal in the end. But frankly, I don't think that works when your sample is so small. And Republicans never talk to pollsters. That's another thing. So, you know, somebody might say they're a Republican, but you have to wonder if they are. At any rate, here you have 53% of Americans would blame the Republicans. And, you know, we just talked a little bit about it, but there is a dearth both in social media and in mainstream journalism of Republican messaging that, you know, is coherent, that everybody's on the same page, everybody, says the same things over and over, like the Democrats do. I mean, how many times you hear Democratic senators especially are very good at messaging. So, you know, what do you attribute this curious lack of cohesion among Republicans? Is it there is no cohesion anyway?
No. that's kind of the dark side of the coin of having a really robust majority party in Congress, and Republicans are enjoying among their most significant majorities in both chambers for the better part of a half century or longer. So you do have a series of incongruous disparate interests that are competing with one another for airtime, essentially. And, you know, it reminds me of the old Will Rogers line, I don't belong to an organized party, I'm a Democrat. That's how it used to be for the Democrats. There was no way to keep Democrats in line in the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, especially after the urbanization, the progressive wave of urbanization. You had a really two-stage party, and that's kind of being worked out now. The Blue Dogs are gone. And the party has become much more ideologically congruous and homogenous, and as a result, they're all lock and step in line with each other. And Republicans are now a little bit more chaotic, and I don't necessarily think that's a bad thing, but insofar as it's presented in the press as, you know, herding cats, it doesn't reflect the scent very well on the party. But it's also, you know, it's a boon insofar as that it demonstrates the breadth of ideological heterogeneity in the Republican Party. So two ways to look at it. But there is definitely no consensus on a lot of these big contentious issues.
Yeah. Well, there's one thing that I think is pretty obvious, and I don't know what I was watching. It was some reality show, maybe it was a series of some kind. Anyway, a couple of young people were sitting around, and they were talking about the Republicans, and she's a Republican. You know, we're not going to hang around with her, you know, that type of thing. The GOP brand, it was young adult, you know, voting age anyway. But the polls reflect that. I mean, Republicans stink. They have an odor about them. And, of course, it doesn't help when you've got Republicans all over the place saying nasty, nasty things about blacks and gays and Muslims and just about anybody who's different than a white American. I'm just wondering, I know, but that's the perception, and you know as well as I do, Noah, that the perception goes a hell of a lot farther than the reality sometimes. And in this case, it's true. Admittedly, most of these people making these inane, stupid, bigoted comments are, you know, bit players. They're state senators and you know, some idiot federal state judge, Roy Moore, for instance. And so it's not like the first team. These are bit players making these comments that are getting wide play on social media and in the mainstream press.
Yeah, I think quite a bit of that is the nature of the press's attraction to narratives that cast Republicans in a bad light. I don't know. Like you said, we're talking about bit players here, and Dave Weigel has a really good rule that he applies to situations like that. It's the amount of trouble that the Democratic Party is in at any given point is inversely proportional to the number of obscure Republicans who show up in the mainstream media outlets. So the Democratic Party is doing wildly well. You'll never hear about State Senator Bob Creek from Red Oak, Arkansas. You'll never hear about it. But if Democrats are not necessarily in the world's greatest position, then all of a sudden that guy's opinion becomes indicative of the entire Republican Party. So
yeah.
I have a tendency to dismiss those kind of things. And when it comes to young people, as you say, having a poor impression of the Republican Party, that's A, nothing new. We're talking about the dawn of time, essentially. And B, maybe a little bit wearing off. I really don't necessarily believe that the Obama coalition will be the Democratic coalition. I have yet to see any evidence that the Obama electoral general election coalition is the Democratic coalition. They are not the same thing. We have only two data points to suggest that they are. And young people swung wildly in the Republican direction by, I think, double digits, according to exit polls from 2014. So
yeah.
You have some movement, and Democrats can take that constituency for granted. I think they probably are tempted to because they've always been there. And there's no question that Democrats are going to continue to win the young vote for the foreseeable future without some dramatic shift. But they can shave off of a series of points enough so that it will be a serious electoral problem for the Democratic Party, and I think that they might encounter that, particularly in 2016 when the youth candidate is going to be the Republican. Whoever wins the Republican nomination is going to be younger than Hillary Clinton.
Yeah,
full stop.
Right.
Full stop.
Yeah.
So grandma's going to be on the ballot. Self-described, grandma knows best, is going to be on the ballot, and the young person is going to be the Republican. So that dynamic is going to shift a little bit in 2016.
Yeah. Fausto, you got a question for Noah? Fausta? Is she off the road?
Did I put her to sleep?
Oh, wait a minute. Somehow she... wait a minute. There you are.
Hey. I didn't think it was that boring.
Okay. On the youth demographic, my son is in his early 20s, and there is a certain shift from the last national election to now that I have observed, particularly as they are either entering the labor market or not able to find jobs, and also when it comes to Obamacare and the fees that they're having to pay. So it's going to be interesting to watch.
I totally believe that. I totally think that you're going to see a real different dynamic. And they said that in 2012, too. Well, you know, the young people are just trying to get into the labor market now. But we are talking about, a generation now that's in. The people who are entering their 20s have, voted for Obama in their first election 2 years ago and are unable to enter the labor market. Voters who voted for Obama twice, who are now in their mid-20s, 24, 25, 26, who perhaps never entered the labor market, maybe took out a student loan and went back to school. And then you have, on top of that, imposed costs on them associated with the Affordable Care Act. And a lot of people who I know personally who are having a lot of difficulty entering the labor market and paying for their own are now also having to pay Obamacare subsidies. And many of them will have to pay a significant tax penalty for failing to buy into insurance in this and the coming tax year. So I think that's gonna shift a little bit. But I mean, like I said, Democrats are still gonna win the youth vote. But I don't see a lot of evidence for the claim that President Barack Obama's coalition that he managed to manufacture twice is gonna show up for a third time.
Yeah, there certainly won't be the youth turnout that there was, and Hispanics will probably be very grateful if eventually, and I think it's gonna happen eventually, there's going to be some kind of immigration reform. There are enough Republicans that want it that it will probably pass. Some kind of immigration reform is going to pass the House. Hopefully not the Senate bill, which is awful. But, there will probably – I still think they're going to have the strategy that Representative Goodlatte wants, who's the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He wants two or three separate bills dealing with separate issues, the border, the visas, guest workers. You get those three through, and Hispanics will be reasonably satisfied, I think, and won't take it out on Republicans in 2016. And if it's Jeb Bush who's the nominee, Noah, he speaks Spanish. He's got a Spanish wife. He's for immigration reform. He's never been against it. Do you think a Jeb Bush would steal some Hispanic votes from Democrats?
He might, but I don't necessarily think that he's the key to the Hispanic vote necessarily. I don't think a personality, frankly, is key to the Hispanic vote. Identity politics is best left to the opposition party, in my opinion.
Yes.
There should be a policy approach that attracts Hispanic voters rather than a persona, ideally. But at the same time, I don't think Jeb Bush is necessarily best positioned to win the nomination at this stage. He's polling essentially well, relatively well, but I get the distinct feeling that he's encountering a very hard ceiling fast with the conservative electorate and even the Republican electorate. So while he's polling pretty well today, I don't think he moves up very far beyond that.
There's also, speaking as an Hispanic, there's also a sizable Hispanic demographic that the Democrats are ignoring totally, and those are the Hispanics who got here legally and paid piles of money and loads of time becoming citizens, who, quite frankly, feel insulted and injured by these motions of the Democrat Party right now, which will essentially grant illegal aliens, and I'm using the term illegal aliens on purpose, the right to vote locally at least. So, being able to collect on benefits and do a number of other things. They are voting now, and they're very insulted.
Yeah, and that's what Democrats think they can get away with. It's pretty hard, cold, hard calculation, but they think that they can make up the numbers they lose among legal immigrants with those who are illegal. And the best evidence for this actually came today, which was so positively brazen that it's hard to even describe how offensively shocking and obnoxious this is. But apparently, New York City has a very controversial policy where they're offering illegal immigrants city-issued identification cards. And they're wildly popular, and they're so that these illegal immigrants can access city services, which are benefit services that taxpayers pay into. It's very controversial, but according to a report in the New York Post, an advisor to the he was either a city council member or an advisor to de Blasio, I don't recall, but said that that this provision has built into it a self-destruct mechanism in the event that a Republican wins the White House in 2016. No joke. So that all this data that the city collects on the illegal immigrant population ceases to exist and cannot be used against the illegal immigrants whom they collect data on for so long. So it's essential, and that it's shocking. It's shockingly brazen, because this is the fact that the opposition party can take control of the levers of government you erect is supposed to serve as a check. That's supposed to give you a sense of posterity and responsibility to history, and to eliminate that with this mechanism, which should be challenged in the courts. I don't even know if it's the constitutional, at least on the state level, on the city level. But if it is, it sets a really horrendous precedent where we're talking about constructing and erecting laws for really temporary electoral benefits, strictly partisan ways around laws like the enforcement of the immigration code, for example. And It's a really dark future that presages. So I really hope that this is not an indicator of where we're going, but I kind of fear that it might be.
Yeah.
And this is one of the things that disturbs me of this administration, the complete disregard for the rule of law in instances like the one you just mentioned, and the fact that Congress should be fighting to preserve its constitutional powers, and the president's attitude is, well, I got a pen and a phone.
Right.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing I'd like to take issue with Fausta is that although legal Hispanics are probably resentful of this all this attention being paid to illegal aliens, the fact of the matter is that the Republicans, the loudest immigration voices on the right, are anti-Hispanic. They are anti-immigration. All immigration, even legal immigration. You got that wing of the party are the loudest, and therefore scared the bejeebies out of most Hispanics, even legal ones. So, you know, I think that is playing against any large scale movement of Hispanics to the Republicans until they can get these loudmouth bigots under control. You know, and I don't know, I don't see that happening anytime soon.
Well, loudmouth or not, the fact is that the female Hispanic woman who is the governor is a Republican, and that two out of three senators in the U.S. Congress are Hispanic also. So these they are
Republicans,
right?
I'm not saying it's true. I'm just saying that's the perception, because they're the loudest. They're the ones screaming about immigration. The sensible Republicans, and I'm not including George Bush in that, Jeb Bush in that group. Sensible Republicans who want sensible immigration reform, sensible border security measures, are being drowned out. I mean, when you don't hear them. Of course, they're probably keeping a low profile because they know if they say anything nice at all about Hispanics, they'll get primaried.
It's nonsense, Rick. For a Republican candidate to the presidency to win, they're going to have to go and deal in the neighborhoods where they're Hispanic, minority, whatever. They have to go into the neighborhoods and do the work the old-fashioned way instead of going for the big donors. They're going to need the big donors, but they're going to also need to get out the vote and get the word to get around. The fact is that illegal immigration is a national security problem in addition to all the other problems that it engenders, and it cannot be dismissed. It's unfortunate that, you know, we have been placed in this situation, but I tell you that there are many, many legal Hispanics who are outraged at the way that the current administration is trampling on the Constitution and on their rights.
Yeah, but are they mad enough to vote for a Republican? That's the question. They might be mad.
Yeah.
They were mad in 2014, and Republicans did get a nice number of Hispanics, but of course the turnout was way, way down, way, way down. So we'll have to see in the general election how that plays out. Well, you know what? We've exhausted immigration. We've exhausted Department of Homeland Security. Let's talk about something fun. Let's talk about presidential politics, because it's always a good subject to talk about 2 years before an election, don't you think, Bella?
Yeah, what could change? Everything's set in stone.
Right, exactly. Scott Walker is going to be the nominee and the next president of the United States. Interesting, though, how three or four major newspapers did hit pieces on Scott Walker in the last 2 weeks. Washington Post leading the way. Evidently, Scott was not a good high school student, and this can't be coordinated, can it? I mean, you know, there is another journal list out there. You might recall journal list being the list of 150, 200 liberal pundits that actually disbanded because their perfidy came to light. But there's probably another version of it, a smaller version. Do you see this as some kind of a coordinated effort on the part of liberal journalists to smear Scott Walker before he even gets started?
No, I don't. I don't see conspiracy theory and media bias. What I do see is like-think, general shared sensibilities. Most of those are biases towards cutting and interesting and compelling reporting in that particular moment. And in that particular moment, it was Scott Walker's moment. And there was a uniform desire to thoroughly vet Scott Walker for reasons that we all suspect they have, which are that they want to cut him down a peg. I believe that that's true, and I don't think you need to have a conspiratorial communications line in order to both all be on that same page. That same page is just sort of communicated by virtue of everybody living in the same business, working in the same business, communicating as friends and colleagues across the journalistic lines. But the reports that they came out with, as you suggested, were really thoroughly uncompelling. Things that were generally known, like the fact that he had no college degree, not because he was a poor student, but because he had a job opportunity his senior year and decided not to finish his college education in order to take a really good opportunity. He did okay for himself. Those are the kind of things that we're vetting Scott Walker at this point because he's been so thoroughly vetted. The guy ran three statewide gubernatorial campaigns, all of which generated national attention. The recall election generated the most national attention because it occurred in the middle of the summer where there was no political season going on, and every political watcher managed to sink a lot of money into it. There was a lot of money sunk into that race, or you were interested in watching it. Nevertheless, it had a lot of interest, and it generated a lot of attention. And so Scott Walker's been vetted, very thoroughly vetted. To the extent that we're learning anything new about him, it's not stuff that people who've been following his career don't already know. So in that sense, he's a really formidable candidate. The press can't really touch him, as demonstrated by it. And another one was his answer on evolution, which is another manufactured controversy that generated a lot of enthusiasm on the left, but is certainly not going to sink his political career. And the fact that he refused to criticize the president overseas. NBC News actually ran a first read column saying that his failure to criticize the president overseas, in deference to tradition, by the way, exposes his weakness on foreign policy, as though any governor doesn't have a foreign policy weakness. He just said basically they would have criticized him no matter what he said. So it really is a lot of weak sauce in the effort to impugn Scott Walker's abilities as a candidate.
Yeah. I don't think he's presidential material myself. I don't know. He's Obama with a few years of experience. He really is ignorant about foreign policy.
He's been governor for how long?
Governor for 6 years.
Well, I'm sorry, not 6 years.
No, you're right. He started in 2011. He's in the middle of his second term right now. He was inaugurated in 2011, so he's in the middle of his second term. He'll finish the majority of his two terms as a state, as the head of a state. And prior to that, he served as a county executive for a major urban center in the United States. So he does have a fair amount of executive experience. Executive experience is good. No governor who has executive experience running a government has foreign policy experience. You learn that. There's a year to bone up on foreign policy and get prepared to face Hillary Clinton, who, by the way, is the only candidate who has a record on foreign policy, and it's a really terrible one.
Yeah,
so if you're going to have to go, if you want to go up against anybody on foreign policy, Hillary Clinton is the woman to go up against.
I suppose. He's also very, I saw a clip of his speech at the Iowa conference, and he came alive a little bit, but previous speeches I've seen from him have been, well, lackadaisical would be a one word that comes to mind. I mean, he's really not, he doesn't have much fire in him. Not like a Ted Cruz or a Rand Paul or who are excellent speakers. Ted Cruz is a stemwinder. He can give a stemwinder of a speech. Of course, I don't agree with him, but he gives a great speech. So, you know, I don't see him making remaining in the front as a front runner very long. I think eventually somebody perhaps Rand Paul will overtake him. I really think that Rand Paul is the best positioned candidate to make a real run. He's got his father's network of supporters across the country. You know, whether that's a good thing or not, that depends on your point of view. But you know, he's got the supporters. He's gonna have money. I put my money on Rand Paul at this point.
The only person who can lose an election based on foreign policy to Hillary Clinton is Rand Paul.
Yep.
He is so fringe when it comes to he is his father's son when it comes to foreign policy, to the extent that retrenchment is the only American policy that will reduce the threat to the United States interests abroad. It's perfectly contradictory and makes almost no sense. And that the United States has instigated the vast majority of these conflicts. Rand Paul would have to defend his father, who is out on every possible propagandist Russian network he can, blaming the United States for forcing Russia to intervene in Ukraine. That's what Rand Paul would have to defend. It cedes the issue of foreign policy to Hillary Clinton. It cedes the issue of Russia to Hillary Clinton, which makes absolutely no sense. It would be a disastrous approach to the 2016 issue of foreign affairs, which I think are going to be a very significant issue in the 2016 race. And it cedes that issue to Democrats and makes them the hawk party at a time when America is growing more hawkish. It doesn't make any sense. It's a bad move, and I don't think he's going to be the nominee.
Yeah, I don't think it's going to happen.
Well, you know, 2 years is a long time. Islamic State isn't going anywhere, and I don't think we're ever going to send 100,000 troops to Iraq to fight them. There is not the political will to do that. And if any candidate would propose to send ground troops to Iraq and Syria to fight ISIS, I don't think they're going to win, because that is a losing proposition. Americans are sick of war, which is why I think Rand Paul in the end will be taken seriously. Now, I think he's going to trim a little bit. Defending his father, maybe he'll end up denouncing his father. Who knows? But right now,
Italy is saying that they're worried about ISIS invading Italy. For the Italian government to come out with such an assertion, there has to be a considerable threat, and no way that an isolationist to the extreme the way Rand Paul is going to get anywhere, I don't think.
And I would push back a little bit, Rick.
2 years.
I would push back a little bit, Rick, on your assertion that the United States still remains war-weary from the Iraq war. We've been talking about that CNN poll today. A whole lot of that CNN poll is devoted to the president's approach to the Iraq war. The majority of the public now disapproves of his handling of that. And when you ask about whether or not ground troops are necessary to combat ISIS in Iraq and Syria, according to CNN, a bare majority disapprove of that, 57%, or I'm sorry, 50%. But 47% want ground troops, and that includes 60% of Republicans, just a small minority of independents, I think it was 48 to 51, and even 36% of Democrats now say that they would approve of the use of ground troops in Iraq and Syria to combat ISIS. It really is becoming a pressing threat. People are anxious. It's not that they want to see ground troops in Iraq again. It's that they're really anxious about this ISIS threat, and it's growing at a really rapid pace. So I don't know whether or not what's going to change in the next 2 years, but we're fighting this war. We're slow walking the war. I don't anticipate that the pace of operations is going to pick up to a point that forestalls ISIS's advance on Erbil, which is happening as we speak, or ISIS's expansion into Egypt and Libya, which is again happening today, this week. As long as that pace picks up, that anxiety is going to be there too, and that's going to be a political force for interventionism, for hawkishness in the 2016 race.
Well, they might support ground troops, the American people, but the experts that I've heard talk about how many ground troops will be necessary, 100, 150,000, same as we used for the Iraq war. I don't think those numbers are going to be, first of all, they're not viable on the current spending level we have for national defense. Okay?
Right.
We'd have to have a military buildup over the next 2 or 3 years before we even considered sending that many men to the Middle East. You'd have to replenish stocks. You'd have to replenish spare parts. All the readiness issues that are going to be cropping up over the next year because of sequester and because, frankly, neither party wants to fund the military to its fullest extent. And, of course, the first thing the military wants to cut is readiness. They don't want to cut force structure or anything else. They want to cut readiness because it's the easiest and least painful thing to cut. So we'd have to have a military buildup over the next couple of years in order to be able to send and sustain a large force like that. I don't think the American people are ready for it. I just don't think they are. So there.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, well, you could possibly be right, and I think that if you were to have a frank discussion with the American people about what it would take for strictly American forces alone, or even a coalition of forces to beat back ISIS, there would be some apprehensions, certainly. But the trajectory of the issue is surprising insofar as that it's pointing towards the Iraq war hangover clearing rather rapidly. So I'm not prepared to predict where that's going to end up. But you're right. If today the president went on television and said, "I want to send 100,000 troops back into Anbar province," now you wouldn't get nearly as much support for that as you do in the hypothetical question. Let's send some ground troops back to Iraq and Syria to fight ISIS.
Yeah, I'm afraid that's the case. And as far as I never thought there was much war weariness. I think there was a revelation by the American people over fighting in the Middle East and what it costs us in goodwill and everything else with the Arab world. I mean, not that we should really care that much if our national security interests are at stake. But, you know, Iraq is doomed. I'm sorry. Everything I've been reading over the last 2 or 3 months points to a breakup. This is partly due to Islamic State, but also the centrifugal forces at work in Iraq having nothing to do with the Islamic State, including the animosity between the Sunnis and Shias, of course, and of course, they both hate the Kurds. That points to a breakup. That's open invitation for ISIS to move in and take up a much larger slice of Iraq. And I don't think even sending troops is going to matter because this is an internal political thing. It has nothing, very little to do with ISIS.
Well, nobody would appreciate that more, that eventuality more than Iran. Iran would love to be able to dominate the Basra area of Iraq, the southern area of Iraq, oil-rich territory, access to the Red Sea. So I don't think the Persian Gulf, rather. So I don't necessarily think that the United States, insofar as it can prevent such a thing, would allow a breakup, even though there is some potential benefits to an independent Kurdistan. But the problems outweigh the benefits associated with that. So if the United States can forestall a bloody sectarian breakup of this country, that would inevitably create a series of satellite nations that would fall into the spheres of Turkey, Iran, and Saudi Arabia. They would like to forestall that if they could. That's definitely not something that's in America's interest right now. But you're right. It might be outside of their control, as you suggest.
Yeah. I mean, you're not going to get the Shias and the Sunnis to love each other, and they're massacring each other again. The Shia militias are just, you know, dozens at a time going into mosques and shooting up mosques and stuff like that. And the Sunnis, of course, are taking it out on the Shias. So it's almost as bad as it was in 2007 before the surge. And, of course, the Kurds are a separate country now for all practical purposes anyway. I don't think they're sending any oil profits to Baghdad or if they are, it's not half as much as what they're making. And of course, their own army is engaged in both Iraq and Syria to fight ISIS. So they're pretty much a separate country already. It's just a question of what happens to the south and to the to Anbar and other Sunni provinces. I don't know. At any rate, I've sufficiently rambled on here long enough that we have come to the end of the hour.
That went pretty
so
quick.
I want to thank my guest, Nora Rothman, who, as usual, was incisive and fun and intelligent and all that good stuff. Noah, thanks for joining us, and we'll have you back on again real soon.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a lot of fun. Talk to you later.
Take it easy. Noah Rothman of Hot Air, and also like to thank my co-host for this evening, the lovely, the talented, the wild, the wonderful, the wacky, Fausta Wurz.
Yeah.
Fausta, thanks for
joining
me.
Thank you, Rick. Always a pleasure and an honor.
So join me again next week, same time, same place. Bye-bye.